sin is a fact of human existence. And God will forgive everyone we know who comes to him in real repentance, but that doesn't change the fact that sin has consequences. And Israel and then later Judah, they both tasted this bitter reality. Their relationship with the Lord deteriorated. They were living in a roller coaster rebellion against him for 400 years, right through the whole of the kingdom era, and they were continually paying the price for this sin. But finally the debt, that mountain of debt, became so large that judgment fell upon them in the form of a military conquest. During the time of the exile, the period that we're considering tonight, there were some great spiritual leaders that emerged. Men like Jeremiah himself, men like Daniel, a prophet like Ezekiel as well. And repentance for a time would have been evidenced by a section at least of the Jewish people. However, this did not remove the penalty for the years of rebellion that they had engaged in. That full price of their sin, which was the exile, it had to be exacted. So we've come to the arc of Bible history, and we're coming to segment number 7 in that arc. We've come through the creation period, the patriarch period, right through into the Exodus, then the conquest where we have Joshua, then the various judges that were ruling over the people of Israel. If every man did that which was right in his own eyes at that period, that's what the Bible tells us. Then we come to the kingdom era, where they have a number of kings ruling over them, some up in the north in Israel, others down in the south in the kingdom of Judah. And then we're coming tonight to this exile era, the 7th period in Old Testament history. So we've got the review, and you've got on page 3 there all of the eras to fill in, the figures, the main figures to fill in, relevant to each era, and then the location. That also would have been the place where most of that history and activity during that era would have taken place. I'm sure your pens are just itching to get down into those columns, fill in all of those places. You'll know them off by heart by now, I trust, and it shouldn't be a problem at all. But we're on to the storyline summary for the exile era tonight. What are we talking about? Well, in particular, Daniel gives leadership and encourages faithfulness among the exiles for the next 70 years. So that's the overarching, the umbrella summary for tonight. Daniel gives leadership and encourages faithfulness among the exiles for the next 70 years. Storyline expansion, let's flesh it out a little. Well, as we've mentioned before, way back in the first lesson in the Basic Bible Study series, some history you will come across in books that primarily are the prophetical books. And that's the case here in the exile era. You read through the prophets, like Isaiah and Jeremiah and Ezekiel and Daniel, and you don't just get prophetical messages whereby they're looking forward into the future and saying this and that and the other thing is going to take place. You get some real-time history that are contained in those books as well. Now, the biblical references for the three main divisions in the exile era, they're going to bring in some of the prophetical books. They are relevant. They were written at the time of this exile. We have three main divisions in the exile era. Number 1 is overthrown. Number 2 is the remnant, how they got on after the overthrow of the kingdom of Judah. And then we have number 3, the exiles after the overthrow. The contrast between the remnant and the exiles is simply this: when the overthrow came in, and Jerusalem and the towns in Judah would have been defeated, then we have some that were left behind in the country of Judah. They were the remnant. Others were carted off into the land of Babylon, and those who were taken away in chains would have been the exiles. So, section number 1 on the page, 4, the overthrow of Judah, the three stages of the Babylonian conquest. We're talking about history that is contained in the book of 2 Kings. We'll read about it there. You'll find a lot of material here relevant to the overthrow of Judah in the book of Jeremiah. He talked about it continually. We've got in Daniel chapter 1 through to Daniel chapter 4 other material related to the overthrow of Judah. Then we've got the book of Lamentations that we've read something from already tonight. And even some of the Psalms deal with this period. Psalm 74 and Psalm 79 would be two examples of that. The Northern Kingdom, as we've discovered at the end of the Kingdom era material, the Northern Kingdom of Israel has been conquered by Assyria, and it's dispersed in the year 721 BC. But the Southern Kingdom, those two tribes down at the bottom of the nation of Israel here, Judah, they receive a warning of captivity for themselves, primarily through the prophet Jeremiah. Jeremiah, we know, was called the weeping prophet, and with good reason. Here is a man with a burden. Here is a man that has a message that really extracts tears out of his heart. Here is a man who feels intensely for the sin that is going on within the nation and for the impending doom that was going to overthrow that nation of Judah. And he could see coming what was going to happen. The Babylonians, God revealed to him by way of prophecy, the Babylonians were going to come in, take over Judah, and Jeremiah is out there and he's preaching to the people and he's warning them, telling them to turn from their course, to repent of their sin, to set things right with God, and the people are only momentarily listening to him. But this prophecy that Jeremiah had been announcing was fulfilled in the year 586 BC. Jeremiah not only prophesied the actual captivity or the exile itself, but he accurately prophesied this captivity is going to last 70 years. And that's exactly how long it lasted. But it didn't happen in a night, nor did it happen even within the space of a month. There were three stages to this overthrow. When Jeremiah's prophecy about the overthrow of Jerusalem and the carrying of her people into captivity to Babylon was fulfilled, it occurred in three stages. Stage one was during the reign of Jehoiakim, and we could describe that as the beginning of servitude. Jehoahaz had been taken off the throne by the king of Egypt, Pharaoh Necho. In place of Jehoahaz in the kingdom of Judah, Pharaoh Necho put Jehoiakim on the throne of Judah. Now, he was saying, you're going to be my servant. You will do what I tell you. He was just a vassal king, a puppet king, a king in name only. And there was a tribute led by Egypt upon the land of Judah at this time. Now, Jehoiakim stayed on the throne of Judah for 11 years. And we can divide that reign into three parts, as we do in the little chart that's there at the bottom of page 4 in your notes. We're talking about the year 609 down to 598 BC. We have the first part of Jehoiakim's reign as the vassalage to Egypt that lasted 4 years, 609 to 605 BC. Then he's under the control of Babylon after that for 3 years, so we have a vassalage to Babylon, 605 to 602 BC, and then we have a period of unsettled independence. That's lasting 4 years, 602 to 598 BC. In the year 605 BC, Nebuchadnezzar marched against Jerusalem. Jehoiakim submitted to this king of Babylon, and he was allowed to stay on his throne as long as he remained Nebuchadnezzar's vassal. So he's really having quite a time of it, this king of Judah. First of all, he's under the control of Egypt. Then when that stops, after 4 years, he comes under the control of another foreign country, that is Babylon. He's never really been allowed to be his own man. The Babylonian king at this time, in 605 BC, took away into captivity from Judah a number of the key men, the young men, that were in that domain. Daniel was one, Hananiah another, Mishael another, Azariah another, those familiar names. Those three Hebrew children, in fact, they were a part of the little captivity that was taken away at this time, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, their Babylonian names. So with this deportation, The 70 years of servitude predicted by Jeremiah in Jeremiah 29 and verse 10 began. Well, how did the Hebrews get on in Babylon? We're given a glimpse of what went on in Babylon during the 3 years that immediately followed the captivity of these Hebrews. Prominent among them was Daniel that we've just mentioned. Nebuchadnezzar commanded when he saw these young men come in from Judah that, "Now I have a job for you. I have a design, a purpose for you fellows." And he thought, "Right, we will train them to be attendants in my court here in Babylon." So the four Hebrews already mentioned were among those who were selected. And we find out in Daniel 1 and verse 8 that Daniel purposed in his heart that he would not defile himself with the portion of the king's meat, nor with the wine which he drank. Therefore he requested of the prince of the eunuchs that he might not defile himself. Now initially that prince of the eunuchs, named Ashpenaz, would not give in to the request of these youths. Although Daniel was standing in favour with him and he liked Daniel, but then he said, "Well, we'll try it for 10 days. Probation period. See how you get on." And this experimental period convinced him that Daniel had the right idea and he would be allowed to continue in this path of no compromise before heathendom. We have in Daniel chapter 2 the great dream that Nebuchadnezzar had. At the end of the 3 years of training in Babylon, Nebuchadnezzar had an awesome dream. Brought in the sorcerers in the kingdom, couldn't tell them what it was about. The magicians drew a blank. The astrologers couldn't work anything out of that dream, nor could they provide the interpretation of the dream. And so the king commands that all of them should be destroyed. But Daniel steps forward and he asks for a stay of judgment and he promises, "I will tell you the dream and I will interpret that dream for you as well." It was a very compelling dream. Nothing less than an unfolding of God's sovereign purposes extending into long centuries to come. The dream outlined how the Babylonian Empire would be followed by a Medo-Persian Empire, then by the Empire of the Greeks, and then they would be taken over by the Romans, and that of course brings us up onto the days of our Lord Jesus Christ upon the earth. He came during the time of this fourth kingdom in Nebuchadnezzar's dream, the time of Roman rule. We're told as well in the dream that at the end of the present age, some of these powers would be revived, consummated in the Antichrist, and finally there would be the overthrow that Messiah, our King Jesus, would inflict upon them. The four men in the fire is a wonderful incident in history that we read of in Daniel chapter 3. Nebuchadnezzar erected a golden image, commanded everybody in the country should worship the image. The three Hebrew children refused. And for this act of rebellion against the king, they were thrown into the furnace of fire and the temperature was hiked up. But we're told that one like unto the Son of God joined them in that burning fiery furnace, preserved them from all harm, and they're brought out and they're now promoted by the king in the province of Babylon. Now, while all this is taking place, to these young Hebrew men who are carried off in the first stage of the captivity into the land of exile that was Babylon for them, while this is taking place in Babylon, back home in Jerusalem, where they came from, there is a rebellion taking place. The king Jehoiakim, who was Nebuchadnezzar's puppet or vassal king in Judah, without any apparent reason, he rebels against the Babylonian authority. Now, he might have been goaded into it by some military party that were paying no heed to the assertions and prophecies of Jeremiah, who was saying to them that, "Oh, these military preparations are an insult to God. Repentance and prayer are the weapons of war that you fellows need at this particular time." Or maybe it was Egypt that organized the rebellion for her own ends. Now, Nebuchadnezzar wasn't able to take the field of battle against Jehoiakim immediately up there in the kingdom of Judah. So he instigated a raid of Syrians and Moabites and Ammonites against Judah. parties of Chaldeans from the garrisons up in Syria joined those invaders, and they swept through the country of Judah and they ravaged it. And Jeremiah writes about what they did in Jeremiah chapter 12 and the verse 9. They left an imprint there upon the prophecy of Jeremiah. From this time, Jehoiakim seems to have lived and reigned in that unsettled independence. That was the third part in our chart back on page 4. First of all, he was under the authority of Egypt, then under the authority of Babylon. Now he comes into the 4-year period of unsettled independence. But it's only a stay in execution. It's only really a little breathing space before the big siege comes and the big taking away into captivity occurs. The coming Babylonian invasion and its results are being preached to them here by Jeremiah the prophet back in Jerusalem. So we have the king's fight against God. How Jehoiakim hoped to succeed in his fight against God is difficult to understand. But he tried this impossible task by persecuting the prophets of the Lord. Jeremiah was saying, you're going to take this whole nation down with you. You can't get away with this rebellion. It's not wise. And the king Jehoiakim was so enraged at the prophecies of Urijah that God's prophet had to run and flee for safety down into the land of Egypt, and he was spirited out by Jehoiakim's father-in-law, brought back to Jerusalem, and he was beheaded there, and his corpse was excluded from the cemetery that had been devoted to the prophetic order. We read of that in Jeremiah 26, the verses 21 to 23. Now the word of Jeremiah was no more welcome than the word of the prophet Urijah had been. On one occasion, when the king is sitting in his winter house, and he's listening to the reading of Jeremiah's first written prophecies, he flies off in rage, gets those prophecies, cuts them up with his penknife, and throws them onto the fire in front of him. So sometimes we refer to this king as the penknife king, the king who mutilated the word of God, Jeremiah 36 and verse 23, and we read about that activity there. Quite expectedly, it wasn't long before God's judgment fell upon him. Nebuchadnezzar attacked, fettered him to carry him to Babylon, but it would seem that this plan wasn't accomplished. Without further delay, Jehoiakim suffered a violent death, received a most shameful burial. We're told in Jeremiah 22, the verses 18 and 19, it was the burial of an ass that was reserved for this man who had sat for 11 years in rebellion against God on the throne of Judah. And God caught up with him. No one can destroy the word of God and get away with it. It will always stand as testimony that each rebel will be sought out by God and effectively dealt with. So that's stage one in the carrying away into exile. Then we have stage two, which is Jehoiachin's brief reign. This is the beginning of the captivity. Stage one was the reign of Jehoiakim, the beginning of servitude. Now we have stage two, Jehoiachin's brief reign, and that's the beginning of captivity. Whenever Jehoiakim died, he was succeeded by his worthless son, Jehoiachin. He only reigned 3 months. Like his father, he provoked Jeremiah, and Jeremiah predicted his end. Nebuchadnezzar, no doubt suspecting revolt, came up against Jerusalem in 598 BC. He laid siege to it. The king Jehoiachin was deposed, and his mother and his harem and his officials and all that they could carry away with them, they deported them to Babylon. Now, on this occasion, stage two, the beginning of captivity, about 1/6 of the entire population of Jerusalem was carried away, in Jeremiah 52 and verse 28, including all of the civil and military aristocracy. Any big noise in the civil realm, any person who was anything in the army, was taken away captive into Babylon at this particular stage. There's no mention here, though, of the priests or of the Levites. We know that some prophets were left behind because Jeremiah escaped the call into captivity, but Ezekiel didn't. He was taken, and so Ezekiel ends up in Babylon. And you're reading in the book of Ezekiel, and you'll read about him saying, by the river Kibar, the river in Babylon. That's where he sat down. That's where Ezekiel prophesied, but Jeremiah stayed at home in Jerusalem. The poorest of the land was left behind in Jerusalem and Judah as well. The treasures of the king's house and of the temple, they had been taken, though the city and the temple were still intact. And so the course of civil and religious life, it wasn't stopped. There was still life in Jerusalem. This is the second stage of the captivity. Jehoiachin, having reigned for 3 months, was followed on the throne of Judah by Zedekiah. He's yet another son of Josiah, a third son here, and he reigns for 11 years. Now the way Zedekiah conducted his affairs, both domestic and foreign, aroused the indignation of the prophet Jeremiah. Zedekiah allowed idols to be installed in the temple again. Once more incense to Baal rose up from the roofs of Jerusalem. Heathen rites were secretly practiced, and human sacrifices even were smoking to Moloch, that false god in the valley of Hinnom. So outlandish practices were being engaged in by King Zedekiah here, and no wonder Jeremiah the prophet from Anathoth continued to rise up there and preach against the king and denounce his court as being disloyal unto God. One example is Jeremiah chapter 32. We have the situation of two prophets against one. In the fourth year of his reign, Zedekiah made a journey over to Babylon. Apparently he was going there kind of meekly to assure the overlord in Babylon that, oh, I'm going to be faithful to you, and I'm towing the line back home in Jerusalem, and I'm not stepping out of place like my brothers did. I'm not causing you any problems. But in reality, Zedekiah went to Babylon to gain time. Because, well, it was a dangerous, a fatal policy that he was following and fostering back home. He was all the time, while he was pretending to Babylon, yes, I'm doing what you tell me to do, I'm being a good boy back home, all the time he was negotiating and arming for revolt. There was some hope of an alliance with the neighbouring vassal states, Jeremiah 27 and 3 tells us, that received prophetic support, for Hananiah went around Jerusalem, and he was declaring that the yoke of Babylon is broken. He was saying that all that Nebuchadnezzar had taken away from the people, it would be restored within 2 years. Jeremiah chapter 28, good days are ahead, this prophet was saying. But while Hananiah was saying that, Jeremiah, at home in Jerusalem, was saying something completely different, and Ezekiel, carried away in captivity, in exile in Babylon, he too was saying the same thing as Jeremiah was saying. He had a different message to Hananiah for the people. And Jeremiah predicted the extermination of Zedekiah the king and his court. And Ezekiel, down by the river Kibar, in Babylon, was seeing visions of the temple, and the temple was degraded, and the temple was being disfigured by idolatry. He knew of the wicked heart of Zedekiah, that he had sworn to Nebuchadnezzar, I'll be humble and won't arm my forces here against you, and yet he was constantly asking for chariots and soldiers to come up from Egypt and to help him. Zedekiah sent ambassadors to Egypt to negotiate an alliance. Ezekiel 17 and 15 notes that, and a league was made between Judah and Egypt, After which Zedekiah openly rebelled against Babylon, 2 Kings chapter 24 and the verse 20. And that brings us to stage 3 in this exile. And that's Nebuchadnezzar's march upon Jerusalem. It's now the beginning of desolation that we are considering. Nebuchadnezzar must have been sick, sore and tired of Judah's kings by now. Pretending we're loyal to you, and then rising up in disloyalty and rebellion on every hand. And he comes against the rebellious people of Judah in person. Palestine is overrun. Jerusalem is taken. Those two strong southern fortresses of Lachish and Azekah, alone they remain unshaken. But the Egyptian army appears, and the Chaldeans, they raise the siege around Jerusalem. Some flee into the camps of the enemy. Some run to the hills beyond Jordan. Some, like frightened doves, they're running away to the mountains of Judea to get away from the forces of Nebuchadnezzar. And when Nebuchadnezzar is seen to be approaching Jerusalem, Zedekiah, the king in Judah, he commanded the release of all slaves to try and avert the disaster that he knew was just around the corner. But now that the danger seemed to be passing, and he thought he was going to get away with what he was doing, he cancelled that emancipation of slaves. Jeremiah cried out against that, protested his decision, or his change in decision, and as a consequence, Jeremiah was put in prison. And we're well aware, having read about Jeremiah, how he talks about his feet are sinking in mire, he's in deep mire, and how down at the bottom of the pit, that was the prison that he was put in. There was a lot of water in there. It was a most miserable place, and they feed him on the bread and on the water of affliction. So the siege of Jerusalem takes place, and that rings a bell with me, of course, being up ministering in Londonderry and taking folk around the walls from time to time and telling them, well, this is what happened way back in 1688 and 1689, whenever the siege began to take hold. Well, we have a siege here in Jerusalem, because the king of Babylon soon returns. The siege is set once more for the last time. It was in January, the 10th day of the 10th month. It was the day of deepest gloom for those Israelite exiles. Great mounds were reared around the walls of Jerusalem, and to make room for these, the houses which the king of Judah had built outside for the pleasant retreats, those houses were swept away. Famine came in, pestilence began to rage, ravage through the crowded population that were within the walls. The store of bread gradually was exhausted, and it was only by a special favour of the king that a daily supply was sent to Jeremiah in his prison, straight from the baker's quarter. And eventually even this supply of bread failed. So they were terrible straits that the people were reduced to as this 18 months of siege proceeded. The end was near, they could not possibly hold out. And we have given a description here provided by Dean Stanley of the closing scene. It was at midnight on the 9th day of the 4th month, answering to July, that the breach was made in the walls. By that time the famine had so exhausted the inhabitants that there was no further power of resistance. The entrance was effected by the northern gale. Through the darkness of the night, lit up, if at all, only by the 9 days moon, the Chaldean guards silently made their way from street to street, till they suddenly appeared in the centre of the temple court, in the middle gateway which opened directly on the great brazen altar. Never before had such a spectacle been seen in the inviolable sanctuary of Jerusalem. Then the sleeping city arose, and he began to describe the merciless slaughter that took place. It might well seem as if from the desecrated temple was heard the rushing wings of the departing chariots, as if Jehovah had indeed cast off the altar round which these savage warriors stood, the sanctuary which they made their own. A clang and cry resounded through the silent precincts at that dead hour of night, as if with the tumult of the great festivals. The first victims were those who, whether from religious or superstitious feelings and duties, were habitual occupants of the sacred buildings, the princes who there pursued their idolatrous rites, the prophets who cried at them in the vain hope that the temple was impregnable, the young Levites and priests who were bound to defend the sacred shrine with their swords and lives, the virgin marble of the courts ran red with blood like a rocky winepress in the vintage. And so we go on and we read in Stanley's description here of this final scene in the siege of the flight from the palace, of the capture of the king, because Zedekiah took to his heels. He tried to get away, tried to get out of the middle of this. And then we come to the fulfillment of Ezekiel's prophecy, a solemn judgment was pronounced upon him. His courtiers and his sons were executed in his sight. Then, according to the barbarous usage of the East, his eyes were put out. And he was taken to Babylon, where, according to later traditions, he worked like a slave in a mill, a feat the more tragical because contrasted with the comparative ease of his nephew Jehoiachin. So we have then the three stages of Judah's captivity. And that's summarized in the chart on page 10, right in the center of the page. The year 606 to 586 BC. First stage in the captivity was under the reign of Jehoiakim. That was 605 BC. Daniel and those other Hebrew young men were taken over to Babylon. Then we have the second stage under the king Jehoiachin, 598 BC. Ezekiel, the prophet, was taken to Babylon at this time. And then we have under Zedekiah, the final king on the throne of Judah, the third stage of Judah's captivity, 586 BC. And everybody left is taken to Babylon. The captivity is now complete. So we have thought of the overthrow. Now the remnant after the overthrow, what life was like in Judah, and indeed what life was like in Egypt as well, because some of the survivors that stayed around in Judah quickly made their way to Egypt. 2 Kings 25 talks about this. The book of Jeremiah deals with it. Lamentations deals with it. Obadiah as well. And some of the Psalms come in at this particular point. So we have the exile of Judah. They're taken into Assyrian captivity, that's the people of Israel, in 721 BC. Judah now is on the heels of Israel, and they're taken into Babylonian captivity, all of them, finally, in 586 BC. Now we don't have a record of Israel's exile. We don't really know how they got on when they were in that captivity in Assyria. But we have a lot of detail about Judah's exile, and no wonder, because Judah was the tribe chosen right from the beginning through which the promised Messiah would come. It was the line of Christ here that we're talking about, this kingdom of Judah. And so it should be understood that when we talk about Judah, or the southern kingdom, we mean Judah and Benjamin, plus considerable numbers belonging to each of the 10 tribes that broke off to form the northern kingdom. And that makes it clear when we read in Ezra chapter 6 and the verse 17. But Judah's divided at this stage. The great majority have been taken away to Babylon. Only the poorest of the people remain in the desolated city and the ravaged country. And yet these poor people constitute a remnant. And their history is of considerable interest. Whenever the fatal blow was struck, Nebuchadnezzar came in person. The siege was led and the city fell. The people were carried into captive in the main. Whatever that fateful blow was dealt, Jeremiah was devastated. And so he wrote the book of Lamentations. Nebuchadnezzar had come in and burned the city, wrecked the temple, put down the walls. And Jeremiah, he's sitting there in the rubble, the smoking rubble of Jerusalem, the city that is lying dear to his heart, and he's crying over all that has happened, how many messages he had preached, how many warnings he had delivered, all of them rejected and neglected. And now this, the city is ruined. And if you can read the book of Lamentations against this backdrop, then you'll understand why in the book of Lamentations he begins by saying, "How doth this city sit solitary?" That's today. "That was full of people. How has she become as a widow? She that was great among the nations and princess among the provinces. How is she become tributary? She weepeth sore in the night. And she hath none to comfort her." He's describing the exile, the captivity, the siege that had occurred, the destruction of his beloved city, Jerusalem. Now the nature, the cause, the design of this terrible calamity, we have it stretching its way through in a most vivid fashion, the book of Lamentations. But we'll talk about the prophecy of Obadiah as well, because Obadiah was another prophet who lifted his voice at this particular time with a word of rebuke. He promised retribution and punishment. He cries out against the cruel joy that the Edomites were engaging in. You see, the people of Edom, descendants of Esau, the brother of Jacob, they'd always been more or less hostile to what had remained of Jacob's seed. And when their day of calamity had arrived there in Jerusalem, those who were now their enemies, the people of Edom, began to clap their hands, and they had a big celebratory party, and they were overjoyed at the overthrow of Judah. And Obadiah looks at Edom and he says, "Now listen here, this is rash behavior. This is uncalled for from you folk." And he predicts the day of their own destruction down there in Edom. And this prophesied judgment that Obadiah delivered did actually fall upon Edom. It's now a matter of history. So we'll talk briefly about the destruction of the Edomites that happened after the captivity of Judah. Lord Claude Hamilton, together with Lord Rockby and Mr. Littleton, visited Petrum in the year 1839, and they bore witness to the desolation that had come upon Edom away back in history and upon the capital city of Edom. And then they quoted some of the prophecies, like what occurred in Obadiah. And they say, "Nothing can exceed the desolation of its present condition, although the signs of its former wealth and power are so durable as to have remained many centuries after it was deserted." And they told us how the commencement of the prophecy has been most wonderfully fulfilled. "For although it was beyond the foresight of man to imagine that so wealthy and powerful a city should be deserted, desolate, yet all human works and habitations are subject to a like fate. But the words, 'I will make thee small among the heathen,' have been actually accomplished to such a degree that the very site of Petrum has for centuries been unknown." And they go on to describe the desolation they find there in that city of Edom. Nebuchadnezzar appointed Gedaliah to be governor over Jerusalem, now that he'd taken out all the kings. Gedaliah was the son of Ahikam. He was a man of good birth, a man of high position, and he was told, "Now you're in charge of the remnant of the Jews, these poor people that are staying here in the city of Jerusalem." Now, he didn't set up the center of his authority in Jerusalem. He set it up in Mizpah, near Jerusalem, and the people rallied around his cause and his standard. But Gedaliah, the governor, wasn't allowed to be this for too long. Ishmael, one of the royal seed, murdered Gedaliah while he was being entertained by him at Mizpah. And with the fall of the governor, the last hope of the reconstruction of Jewish society upon its ancient foundations went down with him. All the people, Jeremiah among them, went to Egypt now, because they were terrified of what the Chaldeans, the Babylonians, were going to do. So it's back to Egypt. We've come through the different eras in Israelite history, and we began with the Genesis era. We went to the patriarch era. We have then the family of Abraham, etc., going down into the land of Egypt. And it took them 400 plus years before they ever got out, because they were held in bondage in Egypt. But now, because of their sin, their repeated transgression, we find that they're back in Egypt. Jeremiah warned that remnant against going down to Egypt. He told them plainly that to go will mean death by the sword, death through famine, there will be death by pestilence. He said, but if you remain in the land, if you stay in Jerusalem and in Judah here, the Lord will establish you. Now, though they made a show of praying to God for guidance on this issue, they went their own way, as Jeremiah 41:17 and Jeremiah 42 verse 3 tells us. And in many cases have we, maybe even in our own lives, of, well, we know what the right thing is that we should be doing. God has said it clearly in His Word through the mouth of the Scriptures. He is directing us. And though we know it to be the right way, we have got another option here, we feel. We have another alternative. We have a better way to the way that God is prescribing. And though we come before God and we say, well, Lord, just get me right on this one. Let me pray to you on the subject. We get up from our knees and we go our own way anyway. And this is what happened here. The remnant went to Egypt, which to them was a land of wealth and a land of luxury, a land of vice and a land of idolatry, and being out of the will of God, they joined in with the prevailing sins down there in Egypt until the prophecy of Jeremiah against them was fulfilled. It's widely believed that Jeremiah, whose voice was never going to be silenced except by death, was murdered by his own people because they could no longer stand his message. It's a case of shooting the messenger. And this they pretty much did. We've come to the final section tonight in our notes on the exile era. First part was the overthrow of Judah. That took us to the three stages of the Babylonian conquest. Then we've had a look in at the remnant who were left in Judah and Jerusalem after this overthrow. Life in Judah and life in Egypt as well. Now we come to section number 3 in the exile, the exiles themselves after the overthrow. Those who were carried away out of Judah into Babylon. How did they get on? Well, this is the lot of those in Babylon. We catch up with their story in the book of 2 Kings. We read about it in Daniel. We read about it in Ezekiel. And we read about it in the Psalms as well. So, what happened to those who were carried captive into Babylon? The city of Babylon was a very impressive place. A vast square, intersected by the river Euphrates, just like London is by the Thames. Each side had a length of 15 miles. It was enclosed by walls that were more than 370 feet high. Can you conceive of that? They were so broad that between the buildings that lined them on both sides, there was room for a four-horse chariot to turn. 100 brazen gates gave entrance to this huge enclosure of a city. And then forests in there, and parks and gardens intermingled with the houses. It was a wonderful metropolis. The streets, pretty much like American cities and like America in general, all ran in straight lines like a grid pattern. And at the river end there were low gates, brass gates they were as well, in that fence that was skirting the stream. The houses were 3 or 4 stories high, so it was an opulent place. The great palace of Babylon was typical of the scale of things there in the kingdom. The wealth of ornament was lavished upon it. It was a spectacle that, well, these Israelites and the men of Judah, they'd been used to looking at Solomon's temple, and they thought, oh, this is ornate, this is wonderful. Solomon's temple is the most beautiful building that we know of upon the earth, but it was nothing to what they saw in Babylon. The great palace of the kings was really a city within a city, pretty much, I suppose, like the Vatican City in the midst of Rome. It had a circuit here of 7 miles. Its gardens rose one above another to the height of more than 70 feet. Its walls within and without were gorgeous with paintings and sculpture. And we have the temple of Bel Merodach. It was the most wonderful spectacle in Babylon, standing in a square enclosure with a side of 440 yards. In the middle there was a tower of solid masonry built like a pyramid, square on square on square. The lowest had a side of 220 yards, and the temple proper was there, a silver shrine, and it was shining out over these vast level plains that surround it at a height of 600 feet. A magnificent, extremely colourful structure. Well, that's the surroundings. What about life itself in Babylon? It kind of paralleled the magnificence of the city. And the captive Jews coming in from Jerusalem here must have been impressed, wonderfully impressed, by the sights that met their eyes, the chariots and the horses they saw, the captains with their bright, brilliant blue or crimson uniforms, the sashes all around them, the elaborate armour that they had, the magicians that were there, the astrologers, the sorcerers, the celebrated wise Chaldeans that we read about in Daniel 2 and the verse 2 and Daniel 4 and the verses 6 and 7, the satraps were there, the deputies, the governors, the judges, the treasurers, the counselors, the sheriffs, all the rulers of the provinces. How impressive it was, as we read off in Daniel 3 and the verse 3. And this is a glorious, gorgeous display of military and official splendor. And the traffic coming up and down the rivers through these many streams or canals leading to and from the Euphrates, on the wide lake as well out to the sea. Well, it was impressive. Isaiah notes it in Isaiah 43 in the verse 14. And then the musical ability of the Babylonians was well documented. You can read about it in Daniel 3 verse 7, for example. And that would have been really splendid as well. The Jews, it must be stressed, were not placed in Babylon as slaves in the way they'd been hundreds of years before in Egypt. They were not under the whip here of the king of Babylon. But they're pretty much colonists. That the king would be absorbing into his own empire. There is no proof at all that a servitude like that of Egypt was repeated in Babylonia. There is no hint that the Jews were employed in the great architectural works of Nebuchadnezzar. Here's a bunch of builders. Let's get them out there in the scorching heat and pay them no wages and work them as slaves until they die. There was no evidence of that in Babylon. Their occupations there seemed to be rather more agricultural. They were found in villages in the vicinity of Babylon, Ezra 2 and the verse 59, where no doubt they followed readily the advice that Jeremiah had given them: build houses, plant gardens, make comfortable homes for themselves. Jeremiah 29, verse 5 and 6 and 7. And it's to be expected here that the Jew, who's renowned for his ability worldwide to adapt himself to his circumstances, and if there's an opportunity to make money and build up the economy, then he will be adept at doing it. Well, they took part in the immense and the profitable commerce that was going on all around them. Ezra and Ezekiel tell us that many of the exiles became rich. And so far from being in a state of servitude, they had slaves of their own, and even treated those slaves very harshly. Another fact that comes into play here is that when they had an opportunity 70 years later of returning to their own native land in Judah, many of them, even though they had felt the misery of being cut off from Jerusalem and not seeing the temple anymore, many of them, they had reconciled themselves to be staying in Babylon. They had come to regard the land of their captivity as their native home now, and they were going to stay, and many did stay. We have scattered references that give us some insights into the life of the Jews during this exile period. And we note these under the map on page 15. Jehoiachin, who was preserved alive after his deportation from Jerusalem, was liberated by evil Merodach about the year 562 BC and was well treated by that king all the days of his life. Daniel and the three Hebrews occupied places of honour and responsibility, as we find when we read the book of Daniel. However, many of the people were only common labourers. Some were oppressed, afflicted, tossed with tempests, not comforted. Isaiah 54:11, Psalm 137:8-9. Idolatry would have been rampant in Babylon, and it's certain that the Jews were cured of that evil before they returned to Judea. We read of false prophets circulating among the people. They were stirring up false hopes, and the word of the Lord was sent against them by the mouth of Jeremiah, Jeremiah 29. And although the captive people had been commanded to settle down in Babylon for the period of chastisement, there were many who couldn't find rest in that faraway city. For the Levite, the disciple of the prophets, the pious and zealous servant of Jehovah, we are told, the captivity, it was a stripping bare, a bereavement of country, of sanctuary, and as it would look to other nations, a bereavement of the favour of God as well. And these people, a total contrast to those who had settled very finely in Babylon, these people could not be happy under the conditions of their exile. They refused to be comforted. Their thoughts and their love and affection was all bound up across the desert to the west. And so in Psalm 137, we have the words, "By the rivers of Babylon, there we sat down. Yea, we wept when we remembered Zion." A psalm in their exile, in their captivity, "We hanged our harps upon the willows in the midst thereof, for there they that carried us away captive required of us a song, and they that wasted us required of us mirth, saying, Sing us one of the songs of Zion. How shall we sing the Lord's song in a strange land? If I forget thee, O Jerusalem, let my right hand forget her cunning. If I do not remember thee, let my tongue cleave to the roof of my mouth, if I prefer not Jerusalem above my chief joy." So there were those in captivity who were longing for home, out there in exile, longing to be back in Jerusalem. It was no doubt people like these that kept in remembrance the calamity that had overcome their kingdom, the causes behind it, the sin that they had committed that led up to this siege and their destruction. And these people, by the observance of fasts, by mourning their current lot, through their tears, they look forward with hope and longing into the future. Let's have a better day, they felt. Zechariah 7:2, 3, 5 tell us about them. But they were there for 70 years in Babylon. Now why 70 years? During the long period of the exile, the land of the Jews had been given over to desolation, just as prophecy said it would. Jehovah had told them that every 7 years the land would enjoy a Sabbath. He declared that if the people didn't obey his will on this issue, that he would enforce a rest upon the land. He told them that back in Leviticus chapter 25. Now when this people, in their desire to be like the other nations around them, came up to God and looked for a king to reign over them, they were told that in that event of them being ruled over by a king, the land would become the king's. 1 Samuel 8:14. But they said, "No, this is what we want. We want a king. Don't want God only to rule over us. We want a king of our own like the nations around." Now the monarchy lasted, that kingship lasted in their country 490 years, during the which time the land did not enjoy her Sabbaths. There should have been 70 Sabbaths over this period of time, 419 divided by 7, and for this reason, the Jews were taken away captive for exactly this period, the period of their transgression, 70 years, and the land had rest. 2 Chronicles 36:20-21. We cannot, in conclusion, I make the point, we cannot get away from what God says. We may think we can sidestep what he has commanded. It never works. His will catches up on us and submits our will to his.